I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello, my lovely betwixters. How are you doing? It's been ages, hasn't it? Or it's not been exactly ages, but I've missed you. It's me, Kate Lister, and you are listening to Betwixt the Sheets. But before we can keep going with this, you know what's coming. That's right. It's the Fair Dues Warning. This is an adult podcast spoken by adults to other adults about adulty things in an adulty way, covering a range of adult subjects, and you should be an adult too. I feel safer. You feel safer. We all feel safer. On with the show. Well, hello, betwixters. I am just browsing through some ancient Greek medical texts. Or scrolls, as one does. That's just how we like to roll here on Betwixt. And do you know what? It is fascinating. I have learnt so much about my own body, I simply had no idea. Let us flick to a random page to see what we can find out. It does seem to be that anything that could possibly go wrong with a woman is about her womb. Frozen shoulder? That's your womb. Ingrowing toenail? That's your womb. Particularly itchy rash? Womb, womb, womb. And this is because of an ancient medical belief in the wandering womb. That's right, Greek doctors actually believed that the womb could up sticks and just wander around the body, blocking up other organs, messing stuff up, throwing things out of whack, and just generally causing chaos. The tricky things, wombs. And it wasn't just the medical authorities who believed this, Plato thought it too. He seems to have been better at philosophy than gynecology. I think perhaps he should just stay in his lane. But he had a go at it as well. So here's a question. If your womb is wandering around your body causing mayhem, how would you get it back to where it should be? Well, one solution was to squat over something that smelled terrible. The idea being that it would frighten the womb back to where it should be. Hashtag science. Don't worry, betwixters, you are in safe hands here. But I wanted to let you know about wandering wombs. So this is basically a public service announcement on sexuality in ancient Greece. And if you think your womb might be on the move, well, you'd be a fool not to keep listening.
What do you look for in a man?
Oh, money, of course.
You're supposed to rise when an adult speaks to you.
I make perfect copies of whatever my boss needs by just turning a knob and pushing a button.
Yes, social courtesy does make a difference.
Goodness, what a beautiful dance. Goodness has nothing to do with it, dearie.
Hello, and welcome back to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, with me, Kate Lister. The ancient Greeks were a very, very clever bunch of people. Well, some of them were. They were apparently the best thinkers in human history, but they didn't get anything right. Not by a long shot, especially when it came to gynecology. But, I mean, 10 out of 10 for effort, guys. Today we are joined by the fantastic, the amazing Professor Helen King, who is the author of so many books on ancient Greek medicine and gynecology, I couldn't even list them here. What this woman doesn't know about ancient Greek fannies is not worth knowing. But the book we're going to be talking about today is Hippocrates Women, Reading the Female Body in Ancient Greece. We will be asking such questions as, how did cultural attitudes affect ancient Greek understanding of gynecology? Was there any concept of gender fluidity at the time? And what the hell was all this floating womb nonsense about? Wandering wombs at the ready, betwixters. I am ready to find out if you are. Hello, and welcome to Betwixt the Sheets. It's only Professor Helen King. How are you doing?
I'm doing fab. Thank you very much, Kate, and it's lovely to be here.
It is more than lovely to have you here. I am such a huge fan of your work. You have written so much amazing stuff, but it's your work on Greek ancient gynecology that I am absolutely fascinated by. And, you know, I think the first place that I encountered your work was the essay that you wrote about Rachel Maines's hypothesis.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The vibrator moment. Yes, I know.
Yes. What I loved about that article is not only was it the precision of a scalpel just taking it apart, but when you're reading an academic essay and you know that the author's pissed off, like that was...
Yeah, you read me correctly there.
Before we even get to that, though, I suppose my question should be, how did you end up researching Greek and ancient gynecology and medicine? How did you even end up doing this research?
That is a great question, Kate, and it's a rather roundabout story. So when I was an undergraduate, I came across the ancient Greek text on diseases of young girls, which is still my favourite, partly because it's really short, so you can get a grip on the Greek very quickly, which is pretty good. But it describes this bizarre condition where girls at puberty suddenly go basically completely raving bonkers and start jumping down wells and saying foul things. You just imagine them going fuckety, fuckety, fuck in ancient Greek. And this is all to do with their blood having got stuck at their diaphragm, which is sort of not exactly what we think of the diaphragm. It is in the middle, but it's sort of like the seat of consciousness. It's affecting their brains somehow, although it's in the middles of their bodies. It's like, you know, ancient Greek medicine is kind of freaky. So that really intrigued me, and I really loved it, and I wanted to work more on it, but I didn't feel you could really put in a proposal for a PhD on ancient Greek menstruation. So I put in a proposal on ancient Greek concepts of time, and after a few weeks on this, I was accepted, and after a few weeks on this, people kept saying to me when they met me in the corridor, oh, what, you're doing clocks, are you? And I'm like, no. Oh, what are you doing? So water clocks? No. Like seasons? Well, not really. And it gradually occurred to me I was actually doing ancient Greek menstruation. So it was time in relation to the female body and cycles and things. And I just thought it was marvellous that there is an ancient Greek text that talks about all that.
That's almost like a Scooby-Doo sneaking in for a PhD. Is that you pull the mask off, you're like, ha-ha, it's ancient Greek menstruation all the time.
Yes.
I'm so glad that you have, though, because it's such... It's a fascinating subject. I'm trying to get your head round how they conceived of bodies, how they thought they worked. And it's so important because the Greeks, they were they're often called the fathers of modern medicine. The ancient Egyptians and some other people might have a few things to say about that, but there's no doubting how important their work was in Western medicine because it just kept being repeated, didn't it? Again and again and again.
Yeah, again and again. And particularly by the time you get to the 16th century, there's this sort of renaissance of ancient Greek ideas, Hippocratic ideas. I mean, I don't want to get into whether Hippocrates existed because he didn't. So let's just leave it there, shall we? But the texts associated with the name of Hippocrates. And they all suddenly made a comeback in the 16th century. And that was because there really wasn't much in existing Greek and Roman medicine that people knew about that was quite so narrowly gynecological. So if you wanted to know things like what remedy to give for this condition or what to do if your periods were too heavy or too light or if you thought your blood had got stuck up the top of your body and wasn't coming down, all these things which were perfectly possible in that model of the body, there wasn't anything else really to use. So to find the Hippocratic texts and translate them from Greek into Latin in the 16th century was a big thing because that brought it into mainstream medicine where all European learned doctors read Latin. So once you've got it in Latin, you can read it. And then it's just a wow moment. Like, gosh, there is all this material. It's the sort of excitement I had as a student, but multiplied big time.
And the medieval Islamic physicians also translated the Greek. So it turns up there as well. So what these people were coming up with has had a profound impact.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just Western medicine. It's in the Islamic tradition too. And some of the texts that are around translated into Arabic were not translated into Latin, for example. So things survive across a lot of different cultures. There's a lot of Syriac texts, for example, that don't exist anymore in the original Greek, but we've got the translation, so we can sort of guess what the Greek might have said. It's a very big tradition, a multinational tradition.
So let's talk about some of the things, big ideas in Greek medicine. One of the most interesting ones, one of the ones that has survived to this day, in the same way that Helen Maines was really interested in it, and it becomes a bit of an internet thing, the wandering womb theory. Let's have a talk about that. What did they really think that the womb just upped its moorings and wandered around the body? What was that?
Yeah, they believed it could influence the whole body. And so from that, it's not such a huge step to say, well, it must actually physically move and put pressure on things. So they believed in a woman, if you had a dodgy pain in your shoulder, it means your womb's got up to your shoulder. If it's a man with a dodgy pain in the shoulder, it means you've been overdoing it in the garden or something.
There was no wandering penis.
Yes, well, quite. Don't go there. But it's that level where everything in a woman's body somehow goes back to the fact that she's got excess blood and it has to come out every month. If it doesn't, it will stay in there. It will rot. Obviously, there's no hormone theory. There's no idea you need to tell the womb lining to shed. It's assumed that because you eat and drink, you are building up blood all the month, and then you have to get rid of it every month. And as I say, if you don't, it'll get stuck. So any pain could be due to a menstrual period getting stuck somewhere. So your first question that a Greek doctor would ask you, an ancient Greek doctor would ask you is, you know, have you had your period? And we all know periods can be a bit all over the place. So if you say no, well, it means you've got blood stuck somewhere. And then you've got the whole delightful raft of therapies to try and get the blood out again.
Do you want to give us a few of the highlights? If I was a poor Greek woman who'd just gone to the doctor with an ingrowing toenail and they'd said, well, have you had your period?
Well, the critical one for me is always, it's the beetle pessaries. It has to be the beetle pessaries. So these are cantharid beetles, as in Spanish fly. So well known in the history of sexuality. So they make you really itchy and uncomfortable. So you take your beetles, you wrap them up in wool, having first removed the head. That's nice, isn't it? And the wings. Wrap them up in wool and you insert them. Like a tampon. And this is supposed to go to irritate your womb, to sort of bring it back again. Of course, it will actually irritate your vaginal lining. So there's a sporting chance you'll bleed just because of the therapy. But the bleeding would be interpreted as, oh, this is the menstrual period that got stuck. Oh, good, it's coming out.
Another one that I've read about, and you can tell me if this is true, was they thought that the womb was attracted to smells. So to try and get it back into where it should be, they'd like waft smells at women?
That's right. So there's this idea that the female body is sort of like a tube with a mouth at both ends. And it's interesting, our words like labia means lips, right? Cervix, neck. It is still in the terminology, mouth at both ends. So what you do is if your womb has moved up, you get the woman to smell disgusting things to sort of send it down again. And you have fragrant, perfumey things going on down the vaginal end. And if the womb has come out, it's prolapsed, you will get the woman to sniff nice things to sort of pull it up again. So, yeah, I'm afraid that one is true.
Was there any kind of corresponding understanding of male bodies? Was there any comprehension that their organs moved around, or did they view it in an entirely different way?
Well, they certainly do move around, but not internally to the extent that the womb does. Plato was quite explicit that wombs move and penises move, but it's this internal invisible movement that's the thing. You can't see where it's gone. You can only try and tell from the symptoms where it might have got to and therefore what sort of sniffy things you need to do or whether you need to put bandages around the woman to hold it back in place or all sorts, really. As puppy dog fumigations as well. Do you want them?
Do I? Yes, I do. We better go there.
Yeah, you look like a woman who wanted to hear about puppy dog fumigations. Okay, so this one is because dogs are obviously, they have litters, they have more than one kid at a time. So if you want a woman to be fertile, you want her to be more like a dog in that sort of positive sense. Dogs are often a bad image for women and for men. But you want her to be fertile like someone that has litters. So you take a puppy and you remove the intestines and you stuff it with fragrant substances. They do like their fragrant substances. Then you put it in a jar You put the jar into a big hole in the earth, which you've left warmed up with coals, not actually fire, but just like warm coals, so that the fumes from this jar and this deceased puppy and the perfumes will all gradually waft up their way up the vagina into the womb, which will increase her fertility.
Oh my God. I suppose this all made perfect sense to them, as mad as it sounds to us. This was cutting edge stuff as far as they were concerned.
Absolutely, absolutely. Of course, if you have got something wrong with you and someone's doing something to make you better, that is quite a positive thing. Even if you don't much like what they're doing, at least it means you're being taken seriously. Yes, you have got a problem, and we've got this way of treating you, and this will work. It hopefully builds up your confidence to some level. And it is indeed, it's cutting edge. Of course, one of the big questions is we don't know how far these written texts by men were replicating what women were doing anyway in the privacy of their own homes, or whether this is some male hideous thing which is being done to women. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot of fun, does it?
No, I just can't imagine going to the doctor and going home with a dead puppy in a jar and just being like, right, okay,
thanks. Try this. We'll try the puppy. We failed on the Beatles. We'll try the puppy.
Let's talk about that article that you wrote about Rachel Maines's book, where she hypothesized that, I mean, she was focused largely on the 19th century, but it's from her book that this idea that doctors invented the vibrator to masturbate their women patients to hysterical proxim to cure hysteria. That was the hypothesis. But she made the claim that this went all the way back to the ancient world. Like, it wasn't utterly delusional. There are bits of it that you can kind of see what's happened there. And your entire article is going, I see what you think, but no. What was she looking at, and what were Greek doctors interfering with their patients?
Well, there's certainly truth in the idea that getting pregnant is good for you in this, because it uses up all that excess blood that you're eating and drinking is producing all through the month in making a baby. So pregnancy is good. Giving birth is good, because giving birth means that you expel any blood that's got stuck in the body and has been hanging around for months along with the baby. So reproductive stuff is healthy. But masturbation to orgasm, not. We're not saying there are no orgasms in ancient Greek medicine. There's a wonderful text which talks about how women sort of produce this sensation and then there's some sort of calming down thing going on, and it all sounds very pleasant. But doctors making you have orgasm historically has been a very odd thing, because orgasm's been seen as bad for you. It's sort of intense. You want to calm down and rest. You don't want to have all that excitement. And the idea that doctors would actually do this, bearing in mind that from the Hippocratic ancient Greek doctors onwards, there's been a lot of unease about having a doctor come to treat your daughter or your wife. What are they up to in there? You know, it's a bit iffy.
Yeah.
Anything involving private parts and doctors is, So you really would not want a situation where doctors are deliberately making you have an orgasm. It's just doesn't work in terms of the patient-doctor relationship for a start.
And as you said earlier, there is evidence that they were putting odd things inside the vagina, beetle pessaries and kind of, but you know, they were gynecologists, they're going to do that. But no, it wasn't about making anybody actually orgasm.
No, and there's some interesting stuff there that is relevant about orgasm and conception, because there are different theories of how you get pregnant in the ancient world. So in some of them, it's just the man's seed imposes its shape on the woman's blood. So women just provide raw material and men do all the work in terms of making a baby. But in other theories, there are two seeds. Men and women both produce a seed, and you have to have both to make the baby. So on that basis, you do need orgasm to get pregnant. But that's not the same as saying that there is this sort of overall condition of something called hysteria, which is always treated throughout history by making women have orgasms. It isn't. I mean, even the word hysteria is not an ancient Greek word. It sounds like it is, because hystera is a word for the womb, but the actual word is never used in ancient medicine.
I've seen that written in Greek medical texts. Male seed, I totally get that. I know what that is. But when they're talking about women's seed, I was quite confused about what do they mean by that? Because for a while I thought it was menstrual blood, but now I'm not so sure. What do they mean when they're talking about female seed?
Some theories it could be menstrual blood. The idea it's got some sort of power as well as just being raw material. But often it could just be referring to something like vaginal lubrication. Just, oh gosh, the woman is wet, so this must be seed. you know, nothing that dramatic. Because, of course, they've got no idea of how it's actually happening. They don't have microscopes. You know, they can't see how a baby is made. And, you know, historically, it's really quite late in the day, as you all know, that people actually see sperm doing their thing with the egg. But certainly, there's nothing eggy going on here at all.
Like, even if the nobody's masturbating patients to orgasm, and hysteria is a modern word, but they did have a lot of concerns around what I've seen being referred to as uterine suffocation. I don't know what they called it. But what was that, just like the womb holding its breath for a very long time? What was what was that?
I love it. I love it. The womb holding its breath is great. It's the womb getting up higher in the body and actually putting pressure on your diaphragm and your breathing organs to the point where you can't breathe. Because wombs are like ovens, you know, so much imagery here. Wombs are like ovens. They're sort of hot. Women are thought to be colder than men, of course, because obviously hot is good, cold is bad, so women are cold. But their wombs are actually hot, and they can sort of cook things inside. They can cook the blood and the seed to make the baby. Wombs are like an oven. There's the bun in the oven image, that your womb is actually somehow helping the seed and the blood mix to sort of rise like a loaf in the oven. So all this heat thing's happening. And if all that hot stuff goes up the body and somehow gets stuck and starts pushing on the organs of breathing, you can't breathe. You're suffocated. That's the idea of uterine suffocation. It's confusing because it's, in Greek, it's hysterike pnix, pnix being suffocation. And hysterike, you think, oh, it's hysteria. It's not a thing called hysteria. It's a symptom of a wandering womb. And it happens to have got to your breathing organs, and that's why you can't breathe. If it went somewhere else, you'd have different symptoms. There's lots of different places wombs can go.
And this is when they'd start whipping out their beetle suppositories and puppy dogs, and if you were lucky, a nice olive oil to just rub on your belly.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's, you'd have to be very lucky to get that one, I think.
Yeah, very, very lucky. Your work was the first place that I'd encountered this idea that in Greek medicine, the body was conceived. So gender isn't, it's understood as binary, but it's not so much that there's a sexual difference as a heat difference.
Yes.
Which I really like. So that kind of opens up the possibility of, well, maybe there was some more fluidity around gender than we think, because it's not that you're a man or a woman. There's this body, and if it's hot, it's more manly. And if it's cool, it suddenly becomes quite girly.
Yep, I think there's something in that. And there are stories of sex change in the ancient world. On your wedding night seems to be a bad moment for women. You might suddenly become a bloke on your wedding night. It's like you've suddenly, your body has changed, maybe under the stress of an imminent wedding, I don't know. And suddenly things will pop out. Undescended testicles will suddenly appear. And oh my goodness me, you can't get married anymore because now you're a bloke. These stories are all over the ancient world, and they're told by non-medical writers too. And they're told in terms of, I myself have seen someone that this happened to. Mm. They're not told as myth. They're told as actual people have changed. But the thing is, you can only change one way. You can only change towards the male, because men are perfect, right? And nature tends towards perfection. So you can only go from girl to boy on that basis. But yes, the idea that it's more about heat does suggest more of a sort of spectrum. And some of the ancient Greek medical texts talk in terms of spectrum, that what your gender identity is depends on where in your mother's womb you were. So there's a theory that the womb has got seven different sections, and they go from girly girls to really manly boys, if you're up that end. And if you're in the womb somewhere in between those, you can be a hermaphrodite in their terms. You can be someone who is of an uncertain gender, because, yeah, just... There's lots of stuff about the womb here. And there's also the idea that the left of the womb produces girls and the right of the womb produces boys. So when the man's seed falls in the womb, can affect the gender and the gender identity of the person that's born. And there's a particularly lovely passage which talks about how, sorry, my idea of lovely is a bit odd. I do appreciate that. But it talks about how it depends on left and right, and the man can try and influence the sex of the unborn child by tying up one of his testicles. This could be challenging, I think.
Listen, they don't have beetle pessaries, so they're fine.
Well, no, but this sounds almost as painful as beetle pessaries, I think. So you can tie up your left testicle, and then only your right one will produce, so you're more likely to get boys. So if you've got man with left testicle tied up, right testicle producing seed, woman lies on her side with her right side down. So the seed goes into the right side. You've got right-sided seed in a right-sided womb, and you might get a boy.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I'll be back with Helen after this short break.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
What I do like about the Greeks is they seem to have a lot of these rules around this stuff and some fairly interesting ideas about the mechanics of it. But pleasure was quite important to them. Like, that comes across. And I've always found that very interesting because I'm endlessly curious as to what happened when we got to the 19th century and or the medieval period, even when suddenly pleasure's bad. Because in the ancient Greek world, pleasure is, it's good. It's a good thing. Like, you know, as long as it's within marriage and we're making babies, if you're a woman, etc. But pleasure's good.
Yeah, pleasure's good. And that's why that you need the woman to orgasm too thing is so important. That actually her pleasure matters. Okay, it matters because of the end goal, which is conception, but at yeah. least it matters.
Did the ancient Greeks, I'm always trying to track this one down, because by the time you get to the medieval period, there's this view that women are far more highly sexed than men, which is interesting because now we've kind of flipped the other way. But for the medieval people, women were just these massive, sexual, voracious nymphomaniacs. How were the Greeks with this? Was that an idea that you see cropping up there?
You do see it cropping up. There's this wonderful myth about the prophet Tiresias, blind prophet Tiresias, who knows the truth.
Yes.
And at one point in his life, he sees a couple of snakes mating. I mean, like you do on
As
a
you do.
Walk through the ancient Greek world, you know. And he kills one of them. And he changes sex as a result. So it's like he kills the female one and he becomes male or vice versa anyway. So he's actually experienced, Tiresias has experienced being man and being woman. So there's another bit of fluidity for you. And because he's experienced both, he flips around. At one point, Zeus and Hera, the chief god and wife, are having a conversation about whether men or women enjoy sex more. Love the insight into what gods talk about over a cup of coffee in the afternoon, in the evening or something. So, you know, is it, you know, what do you think? And they say, well, we can't decide here, really. We'll bring in Tiresias because he knows. He's done it. He's done it as both. So he comes in and he announces that women enjoy it more. And that's when the goddess Hera is so cross because that was a secret. She didn't want anyone to know she was actually enjoying it. So she's really cross with him. And that's when she strikes him blind. So it's really interesting that there was a conversation about this.
Yeah.
And that it's between the gods. And it comes out that, you know, it's women. Women enjoy it more. But then there's the question of they might enjoy it more, but is it more intense for a man? So how do you measure enjoyment? Is it length? You know, is it duration? Is it intensity? And they go, well, yeah, okay, women, more duration, but men, maybe more intensity. Too much information, isn't it, really?
The understanding of the body and gender differences is, you know, caused by heat, but it is still quite binary. How are same-sex relationships conceived of in the ancient world? Was it just like you've got a bit too much heat and they don't have enough heat, so therefore you're... Because we like to think about the ancient Greeks sometimes as, you know, it was this kind of like gay paradise. And it's always like, I wish I could tell you that it was, but it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, it is, I'm afraid. It's always nice to find a gay paradise, but on this occasion, really not. So with the Greeks, it does seem to be that there's quite a fixed pattern where it's an older man with a younger boy just until his beard starts to grow. It's a very one-sided thing. It's seen as quite educational. It's sort of good for the young boy to have an old chap to look after him. That's lovely. It's quite romantic. The older chap will give gifts, you know, like a hare. Not quite sure why. You often see a young man clutching a hare on a vase and an older man putting his arm around him. That's very lovely. Or he might give him a flask of olive oil. And he has to sort of woo the young boy. The young boy must say, no, 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 definitely not. And then eventually go, well, yeah, okay, if you must, but just between the thighs, you know, nothing else.
Right. Okay.
It's very ritualized. And there are examples, a few examples, of people where actually then haven't got this big age difference. They're more like what we would think of a couple. And it's not something that you just stop when the boy grows a beard. But these are really, really, really rare. And they're considered odd. You know, you're supposed to start off with your boy and encouraging him to become a nice young man and giving him presents and things. And then the boy will grow up and he will marry a woman. And then in turn, he will be the older man who's looking after a younger boy. So it's much more fluid between what we would see as different sexualities.
But there was shame attached to being to a same-sex couple of the same age. What kind of shame was it?
Well, it's like, you're not a proper man, really. Can't trust you with anything. You're not a proper man. None of these categories really match that well. So, for example, things like being interested in personal grooming as a man.
Yeah.
You know, plucking your legs and making sure you smell lovely. That is not seen as a gay thing to do at all. It's seen as a very heterosexual thing to attract more women.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not at all easy to match their categories onto ours.
And what about women having sex with other women? Do we have much record of them?
Well, there's the famous poet Sappho, of course, Sappho of Lesbos, mm-hmm. as in lesbians, and her poems that survive in fragments are very passionate about women. And it's been suggested that she's like a sort of chorus mistress figure, that she has these young girls who sing her poems for her.
Wow.
And she gets connected emotionally and physically with them. We don't know. We just don't know.
Just don't know.
But it's that thing again, if we believe that the big thing about sex for ancient Greeks is penetration, then if there isn't any penetration, it's not very interesting. It's not really sex. Things about who penetrates whom, who's the dominant partner. And when it's both women, it's kind of irrelevant.
It just tells us so much, doesn't it? Just like all these lesbians just absolutely flying under the radar. Just like, no,
yes,
no, it's just jolly japes.
It's just jolly japes, you know, we're just in the women's quarter of the house, you know, this is my friend.
But there were erotic texts written in the ancient Greek world, weren't they? That and there's a kind of whole debate around what do they function as? Is it pornography? Is it humour? What is it? But they write about sex quite a lot. It's quite a fun topic of conversation for them.
Yeah, they write about sex. There's lots of debates about, is it better with women or with men for a bloke? You know, as in you can fall in love with a bloke better because blokes are more wonderful. You know, you can really appreciate a man's soul in a way you can't appreciate a woman's soul.
Nice.
So maybe love of men is better than love of women.
Mm-hmm.
There's those sorts of discussions. And then there's this extraordinary tradition of pornographic manuals or whatever you want to call them, sex manuals, how to do it, which exist. And bizarrely, it was not till the 1970s that a fragment of one of these actually turned up in papyrus, as in, oh, look, this looks like the lost manual of Philinus, the dreadful sex writer from the ancient world. Philinus, probably 3rd century BCE, Philinus, maybe. And we only knew about it from Christian writers who were saying, oh, these dreadful Greeks, they wrote disgusting books. Ooh, Philinus, ooh, it's horrible, just disgusting, don't go there, filthy book. And Philinus turns out the chapter that we seem to have in this papyrus is much more sort of how to meet a nice girl.
Oh.
You know, it's not straight in there. It's the sort of, first of all, you need to find a girl and be nice to her. And then maybe, you know, maybe a bit of kissing.
That's kind of sweet.
It's very sweet. The lists of sexual positions, which is what the Christian writers imply all this is about, maybe that was like chapter 10 or something. You know, you've got to actually meet someone first, haven't you?
Was Philinus a real person, do you think?
Good question. Don't know. Was Philinus a woman? Was Philinus a man writing as a woman? Because, you know, writing in drag, it's one way of saying, I've got authority, I'm actually a woman, but maybe they weren't. So we don't know, but it's wonderful to think they actually had these books. And they sort of fit with the visual arts too. So we read about little paintings of sexual positions that people like the Emperor Tiberius would have on his bedroom wall to give people ideas. And possibly they were connected to the books. You know, here's chapter 10, number one, and here's chapter 10, number two.
Even if Philinus didn't exist, the fact that these texts are authored in a woman's name is still really important. That still tells us something about how women and sex were viewed in the ancient world.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's very important. It's back to what you were saying about the idea that women were actually the ones who were sexually voracious, not men. So they're the ones who write these books.
Another woman who is possibly a myth slash almost certainly, but I wish she wasn't. I'm going to butcher my ancient Greek now. Agnodice, thank you. Tell me a bit about her, because I was so rooting for her. And then I got to the end and it was just a note going, yeah, probably none of this happened. I was like, no.
Terribly sorry. I know, she's great, isn't she? So it's a story that turns up in the Roman Empire, but is set much earlier, set sort of 4th century BCE. And it just turns up in one author, Paeginus, and it's a really short version of it. It's like he's summarising something that maybe one day we'll find on a papyrus, you never know. And so she's supposedly the first midwife or the first obstetrician or the first female doctor. It's not clear which. She wants to learn medicine. She can't, because at that point only men can learn medicine. So she cuts off her hair, wears male disguise and goes off to learn medicine. And then she comes back. She hears a woman crying out in labour, possibly, crying out in pain of some sort, goes in. The woman says, "Ooh, but you're a man. I'm not going to show you my bits. It's lady parts here." And Agnodice says, "But I am a woman, da-da," and lifts up her skirts. At which point the patient goes, "Oh, yes, you are, aren't you?
That'll do it.
Okay, doctor, I'll talk to you." And she goes on doing this so successfully that the male doctors find that they're losing patients. No one wants to see them anymore. They're all going to Agnodice. So then they decide that she must be, they assume she is a bloke. The drag is very successful. They assume she is a bloke. So they say, "Okay, you're clearly seducing your patients. That's how you're getting so many patients. You're having sex with them."
What other reason could there be?
Isn't it a great logical conclusion? You know, a successful doctor must be having sex with the patients. So Agnodice is brought to court and they say, "You've been having sex with your patients." And she goes, "No, I haven't." Lifts up her skirts, goes, "Da-da," again. "Oh, no, you can't. You're a woman." Okay. So then they change the law. I mean, it's a completely bizarre story. They change the law so women of free birth, and so not slave women, can learn medicine. Well, this is just completely bizarre because there's no evidence for such a law anywhere. There's no evidence for anything, but it is a fantastic story.
Were there women physicians, like actual ones that we know? Oh, there were. Tell me a bit about what the evidence for them is.
There's gravestones where people are described as a doctor and they use the sort of female version of the male word for doctor. So it's just like they're exactly the same sort of doctor as a man is. We know that it's just a myth that women were always illiterate and, you know, never, ever learned anything. Some women have always been educated, particularly if their parents are educated. If they've got a father who's a doctor, you might well teach your daughter some medicine so that then when you go and see patients, if they are going to go, "Oh, I'm not showing you my bits because you're a man," you can say, "Oh, my daughter will come and see you. Oh, okay." So that's been the case throughout Western history, that there have been women learning medicine in medical families. And the ancient Greek world's no different. There are women doctors and there are women midwives who supposedly are, well, they're credited with having written books on medicine, which of course are lost. So there is a tradition of women as doctors, which is great.
You'd just love to know what they thought about this wandering womb stuff and squatting over a dead puppy and all of that. Like, is there a book somewhere written by a woman just going, nope, this is all gibberish?
It would be great, wouldn't it? The thing is, the only quotes we have from these lost books are told to us by men who, of course, pick the bits that fit with their theory. So you get the impression that the women were saying just the same thing. We don't know that.
We just don't know.
Again, it's go back to those papyri. We need to find more papyri.
The Greeks seem to have a real thing about modesty and chastity in women. And I'm always quite interested in how this particular circle is squared, because on one hand, you've got this narrative around women enjoy sex far more than men. Women need to have sex for their wombs to be healthy, seems to be something coming through. If you don't have sex, you might jump down a well, which is always a danger. So there's this idea that women by their very nature are weaker and need more sex. But then conversely, it seems like the nicest thing you could say to a Greek woman is that she's modest and chaste. You see that turning up everywhere. What's that relationship going on?
Somehow you're supposed to tame it all with marriage. Once you're married, it's all fine. As long as you don't stray outside the marriage. It's marital sex is what you need, not just sex. That is complicated, isn't it? It's very complicated. It means you're somehow supposed to transform from this totally innocent creature into a sort of sex-crazed wife performing in the bedroom.
But only in certain conditions.
Only in certain conditions. It's extremely restrictive and complicated.
You wouldn't be able to keep up with this at all. What was their view on monogamy, just out of interest? Because, you know, women are sex-crazed maniacs and men are much more controlled.
Monogamy, basically monogamy for women. But of course, men are perfectly okay having all sorts of other things on the side, whether that's women that they've taken captive in battle, you know, because why not? Or whether it's prostitutes, sex workers, whether it's having a sort of concubine on the side who is your regular extramarital partner. Men are expected to have extramarital relationships. Women aren't. There's nothing, you know, that's basically the historical position, isn't it, throughout Western culture.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Did they have laws around adultery? I know the Romans at some point were threatening people with death for daring women for straying outside the marriage.
Yes. So it's quite complicated. So that if a man has a relationship with an unmarried woman, then that is not acceptable because she's the property of her father. So you're actually interfering with another man's property. So even though she's not married to someone else, so it's not adultery for her, it's a property relationship that you're interfering with. So there are problems with that. And of course, in lots of ancient cultures, if a woman doesn't cry out for help when someone rapes her, she is somehow guilty. And if she says she cried out, but no one heard her, well, she's still guilty. It's a very serious double standard problem. You don't look surprised.
No. It's just horrible when you see, you just look back and you think, my God, it's awful the way this stuff is thought of and written about. But my final question to you, although I could just sit here and talk to you about this forever, you've been absolutely fascinating, is we are now thousands of years on from when the ancient Greeks were writing. We do not believe in wandering wombs or uterine suffocation or hot and cold bodies and da-da-da-da. But can you see an influence of this, these very early ideas, continuing to this very day?
I think if you look at the evidence today about whether women are taken seriously with body problems, that's pretty revealing, isn't it? So like how long it takes you to get diagnosed with things, endometriosis being the classic one, whether you're taken remotely seriously when you say you're in pain, whether pain is seen as something that's quite normal because you're a woman, you know, so of course it's going to hurt. These things, I think, are still left as a residue from the sorts of things that were around in the ancient world. There's some fascinating material in the 19th century, of course, about anaesthesia in childbirth, painless childbirth, and people arguing, well, you can't possibly have painless childbirth because it's supposed to be painful, you know, and if it isn't painful, it doesn't work. And the Greeks are fascinating because they have different words for pain. So for childbirth pain, it's ponos, which is also the word you use for agricultural labour. So like hard work to get a result. It hurts and that's okay. Ponos.
Oh my
so childbirth
God.
Pain is regarded as completely okay because, you know, you have to.
Wow.
To get the result. And that certainly goes all the way through into the 19th century.
Wow.
When anaesthesia in childbirth starts to come in. So that would be a really good example of the continuity.
I was talking to my mum just earlier today. We got onto the subject of menopause and perimenopause. Mm. And she told me that when her mum, who really struggled with it, went to the doctor, it happened to her quite early. She was like 38 or something. The doctor's response was to go and have another baby.
Oh, great.
That sounds quite Greek.
Yeah, that's very Greek. Well, certainly, you know, when I was growing up with endometriosis, they always said, oh, if you had a baby, you'd be cured. That is just a direct quote from the Hippocratic text. If she has a baby, she will be healthy. Well, no. And actually, to sort of suggest that to an unmarried 16-year-old is not terribly helpful anyway.
Jesus. I mean, no, that's almost the same as an ancient Greek woman just going in saying, my toe hurts, and I'm going, when was your last period?
Yes.
Isn't it? It's like the same stuff going on and on and on.
Yeah, I think it is.
Oh, Helen, you have been absolutely fabulous to talk to today. I've enjoyed every second of this.
It's great material, Kate. It's great material. You can't go wrong with this material.
Well, people do go wrong, and then you write academic articles about how wrong they've been, which are brilliant. If people want to know more about you and your work, where can they find you?
All over the place. I blog on Mistaking Histories. That's a WordPress blog. So I've do some of my health stuff there. I've wrote a very short book called Greek and Roman Medicine, which actually doesn't specifically talk about women. It just talks about medicine because women are part of medicine. That's my really short go-to read, Greek and Roman Medicine. And I've got a book coming out later this year called Immaculate Forms with profile books, which looks at clitoris, hymen, womb and breasts through time.
Amazing. Oh, I look forward to that one. Thank you so much, Helen. You have been a treat.
Thank you, Kate.
Much for listening, and thank you to Helen for joining me. And if you like what you heard, please don't forget to like, review and follow along wherever it is that you get your podcasts. If you'd like us to explore a subject, or maybe you just wanted to say hi, you could email us at betwixt@historyhit.com. We've got episodes on everything from Elvis Presley's sex life to the myth and history of the menopause all coming your way. This podcast was edited by Tom DeLaghi and produced by Stuart Beckwith. The senior producer was Charlotte Long. Join me again, Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, a podcast by History Hit. This podcast contains music from Epidemic Sound.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Wayfair's biggest sale of the year is back. Get ready for Wayday. For 3 days only, May 4th through May 6th, you can get up to 80% off at Wayfair. Save on sofas and cookware, dining sets and rugs and beds, wall art, bar carts, floor lamps, ceiling fans, home decor, all things outdoor, and way more. Plus, everything ships free. Don't miss the sale to get up to 80% off everything home, even a garden gnome. Wayday starts May 4th. Head to Wayfair.com now to start filling your cart.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Betwixt the Sheets. Please follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use the code BETWIXT at checkout.